So first, first day, what a mess, you know? It's like you're supposed to just sit down and do the practice. Come on, you know? It's sort of you're all over the map, and this is basically it really, there's a thing called collecting, and the collecting just takes time, you know? So if anything, the first day, it's really to be more about self-acceptance and patience. You know, you just have to go, okay, I'll try to go back to breath again. Okay, I'll try again. I'll try again. So that's really what's going on here. So I thought just to begin with, I would, one of the lovely things about bears is they're, you know what a totem is, in the Native American tradition, and they are, sometimes huge, huge creatures, you know? And so I'll tell two stories, and then I got something good to read. One is kind of scary one, you know? There was a young lady who later she was a nun for 20 years, Tani Santo, and she started out, she was just a traveler, and this was in Dharamsala where the Dalai Lama lives. There's a forest above it, maybe not different than this pine forest, and about 8,000 feet. And she was out walking, and a Himalayan black bear grabbed her by the head and shook her. And I don't know if somebody came by or something, but frightened the bear, and the bear left. And then, I mean, it's a great story because for years there, once she became a nun, of course, she had these teeth marks in her head that were quite obvious, you know? So that's one story. Don't worry. And the second one's a better story, you know? And actually, it happened over here at King's Beach. Up above it, I was staying with a friend, and early morning I got my cup of coffee, the precious thing, and I went out and I was sitting on a little chair, and there's a deck there, and I'm sitting there, and this bear comes up on the deck, saunters up, and he's not little and he's not big and he's not old and he's not young, just a regular old bear, you know. So he sits on his haunches, and I'm sitting there going, "Well, what do you do now?" I kind of looked at the door, and I said, "Oh, I know what. I'll give it a Dharma talk." So for the next half an hour, I had to practice. I was just, I don't know if I was teacher in training then, but anyway, I decided this was the right thing to do. And it sat there. And at first it was like, so I just didn't want to, cause trouble, so. They say, well, talk softly, be a nice guy, all that stuff. So I did, And so she, I don't know, sat there for half an hour, And then at some point, it's sort of like, okay, I got it. I thought, phew, pull that one off. And he stood up and walked off, And so those are kind of the stories here. And I hope, I live just about a little lower altitude here, just to cross over Nevada City, and I live out the end of the end of a dirt road that then there are literally thousands of acres drops down. So bears come up and visit. They like the compost and stuff, So I'm used to them, and I stay out of their way though. But I thought I would read this just because. It's like first day, You've been sitting there trying, and I don't know. I hope you did okay. If you didn't, it's still okay. So, it kind of works like that. So this is, okay, I'll read it to you. This is, my husband spent last summer at my family's cabin in Grand Lake, Colorado, at the edge of the Rocky Mountain National Park. In town one day, I picked up a pamphlet on living in bear country and the suggestions of what to do when you meet a bear. Sounded a lot like meditation practice. So I substituted thought for bear. And here are some of the helpful hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. We could say California has been a home to thoughts since their earliest ancestors evolved in North America. Today, increasing numbers of people routinely live and play in thought country. Learning about thoughts, being aware of their habits, will help you fully appreciate the uniqueness and the habitat in which they live. What to do if you meet a thought? There are no definite rules about what to do if you meet a thought. Thought attacks are rare compared to the number of close encounters. However, if you do meet a thought before it has time to leave your area, here are some suggestions. Remember, every situation is different with respect to thoughts and the activity, the terrain, and person involved. So, one, stay calm. If you see a thought and it hasn't seen you, calmly leave the area. Stop. Back away slowly while facing the thought. Give the thought plenty of room to escape. Three, wild thoughts rarely attack people unless they feel threatened or provoked. Four, speak softly. This may reassure the thought, this was my Dharma talk, reassure the thought that no harm is meant to it. Relax. If a thought stands up and moves closer, it may be trying to detect your scent. This isn't a sign of aggression. Once a thought identifies you, it may leave the area and try to intimidate you by charging to within a few feet before it withdraws. Now, if that happens, whoa. But thoughts, this happens all the time. So, don't run or make any sudden movements. Running is likely to prompt the thought to give chase, and you can't outrun a thought. If you have, anyway, I don't need to read the rest of it, but I think you get the point, you know. Anyway, first day, now you have the instructions if you do run into this mangy creature. So tonight, first night, first, you know, part of the fundamentals. You know, the Buddha said for 45 years, in every talk, he spoke the Four Noble Truths. You know? And so these are sort of the foundation of the pivotal things that all this stuff kind of is defined by, works with. And it's essentially, you know, anxiety, suffering, dissatisfaction. You know, it's kind of, in a sense, a norm for culture. And that there is, he simply said there's a cause to it. He used the word tana, which simply translates as grasping. Okay? I'm just going to go through these, and then I'm going to backtrack. And then the nature of grasping is understood, which is part of our process here, then the third noble truth is nirvana, which sometimes is just translated as the blowing out, extinction. But another, the word I prefer is peace. You know, then there is peace when we have kind of understood that. And that then there's what is known as, which we are treading on, the Eightfold Noble Path. You know, and again, it's, you know, it's right intention, right speech, what is it? Right thought, right speech, right action. Kind of backwards. Anyway, that's all right. Doesn't matter. You know, because actually, it's the wheel of the law, which means it can start anywhere. But right action, right livelihood, then there's right mindfulness, right insight, right concentration. So that's it. So it's basically, it says that there is a way. There is a very clear and defined path that leads us from anxiousness, suffering, confusion. And again, to define it correctly, because I think sometimes, but Buddhism has a bit of a negative connotation since the first noble truth is a negative, you know. But I think of it more as it's just a truth, you know. But people look at it and say, oh, Buddhism is a negative religion. Well, I beg the pardon. It's a hopeful because of nirvana. So really what it is there is a problem, and we look at it from a diagnostic point of view. There's a problem. There's a diagnosis, which is this tanha or this grasping. There's a prognosis. You're going to be fine. And there's a treatment. So that's just the fundamentals of it, you know? Really kind of, you know, in a way simplistic, and yet, you know, due to our, you know, the what they call the places or the poisons of, which are those things that hold us in grasping, which are traditionally, they're translated as greed, hatred, and delusion, you know? And they start out very simple. It's pleasant, unpleasant, and not pleasant, not unpleasant. So it starts out very simple. But then as we, with actually the delusion, we create bigger and bigger problems. So these kind of, I'm just trying to, I have to give baseline. That's baseline. And you have to have a kind of good foundation for this stuff to work. So there's another piece I'm going to work with here. And it's actually comes from the practice itself. And it's also therefore. And the first one is usually translated as calm abiding, or sometimes the word samadhi is used. And calm abiding. So we're here in many ways one of the precursors to the fundamentals of this practice. Is that we have to, in a sense, you know, we have such a, it's true, it's got, we've gotten more chaotic, I think, with all the, you know, email and phones. Oh my gosh, it's just like an amazing amount of distraction available. And actually the distractions are quite addictive in many ways, you know. But we've come here, and this is really why I ask you, you know, don't look, you know. And usually, you know, I taught, 15 of the second part of the two-month retreats at Spirit Rock. And it was amazing, you know, people, that finally could come. They would, you know, sneak off, and one phone call or one email, and their whole practice would collapse, you know, and usually it wasn't anything, you know, but it's just, you know, there's a word, papancha, which is mental proliferation, that you take something, and even though it may not be such a big, and we make incredible things out of it, you know, so careful, you know, that's why the whole thing is, you're here. And part of my job, and Richard's job, is we're trying to we're trying to create a protected environment, you know, where you, first of all, you can kind of settle down. And I know today this is one; it's a tough day, you know, because if it isn't the body, then it's some storyline that you got, or something somebody said a few days ago, or. Your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your aunt, your uncle, somebody, you know, there is something that's sticky, you know? And the stickiness kind of entraps us in a certain way, you know? And we proliferate with the material. So we want to keep it as, you know, I think the biggest piece, you know, one thing of having sat for, I don't know, actually, I figured by the before I was 30, I'd already sat for 2 years, you know, just in India, in the first years I lived there, it was, you know, there wasn't a lot. It was actually pretty quiet, you know, and so there wasn't a lot of stimulus available. And still, it was really hard, you know, because this whole process of calm abiding, this ability to, in essence, kind of collect yourself. It's not that it's you know, it's not like you have to be this fierce warrior that's kind of, you know, no. All you have to do, in some ways, is get out of your own way. You know, don't make more out of what there is. You know, don't do papancha. Don't proliferate. Simply keep coming back to simplifying. And even, you know, we go, oh, concentration is such a, you know, it's an important part of practice. Well, more than anything, it's probably simplifying. And the nature of your mind is that when that stimulus isn't there, it calms down. So it really kind of rests in this calm abiding. And then there is a natural, you could say there's a natural collecting of concentration that's a necessary part of this practice. You know, I wish I could say, you know, you could just kind of run around and get it. You know? This is a very specific environment created, first of all, for the calm abiding. And there are many, the samadhi, there are many levels to it. But for all practical purposes, which is really, they talk about it as excess concentration, is that it simply means that one of the things is, what are the method, one of the method, big methods we use here, a thing called restraint. You heard of this one? Not very popular with the kids, but it's, you know, it's actually this, creating this boundary, you know, that allows the system to calm down, to simplify, and to collect itself, you know. And if it collects itself in the proper fashion and manner, then something, which is the second part of this, the four of these, I'll just go through them, and then I'm going to stay on this one for a moment. There's calm abiding. There's a thing called insight. That's why we call it this practice. And then there is sometimes referred to as one taste, or I like the word single taste, which really has to do with that nibbana. And then instead of like the path itself is undisturbing awareness. So the fourth piece is undisturbing awareness. Okay, so I'll go back, because the calm abiding, this is where we're at right now. And in many ways, you cannot rush this. You know, I wish you could do the same thing in 2 days that it takes 7 days. It doesn't work that way, you know. It actually takes time, you know, and it's one of the things that, you know, in our culture, we've tried to speed everything up and have, you know, instant, do they have instant calm yet, you know, or, you know, but, you know, maybe in a little jar. And,
yeah, they have calm in a bottle.
In a bottle now, yeah. Well, you know, but that's it, you know. You go, oh, no, this actually takes restraint. It takes, in a sense, and it's very tricky, the word in our culture, Western culture, the word effort, you know. And the Buddha, again, says, oh, there has to be effort. But there's different, you know, I mean, I see Asian effort different than Western effort is based on getting something, you know? If I do this, I'm going to get something. So, you know, I put effort in to get it, you know, whether it's, you know, all the different lists. There's also the effort of being. You know, it's actually this ability to simply stay. And this is really what I advocate. The other, the calm abiding, the samadhi, it will happen on its own if the components are all there. And the components in this case are actually, you know, we talk about, oh, stay with the breath. Well, if you just sat there and you didn't argue with yourself and you didn't make up any more stories and you didn't try to fix everything and, you know, something with the past and something about the future, if you did none of that and you just kind of sat there, maybe like the bear, you know? And the Dharma itself would reveal itself. And it's really, this is the kind of trick here, is non-interference, you know. So if you sit there, you know, you don't have to have the effort to somehow, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm not getting this, or, you know, the way I've ever gotten anything in my life is I've pushed and I got effort. And I know, I was, you know, I was a definite pusher type, you know. But also what's good about pusher type in this kind of practice is, guess what? You can push as hard as you want, and the only person that's going to die is you. You know? And what are you going to get for it? Nada. You know? You're not really going to get anything, you know? So the thing is, you can push and push. And a lot of the kind of cultural references, you know, somehow you're pushing. And there's some of the ideals here are problematic to me. Is that somehow, and this is really, doctrinal kind of view, is one is that nirvana is something to be achieved. And therefore, in the Western vernacular, that means that you have to push, you know. But there's also another kind of way of seeing this. It's more where I sit these days. And it's not through effort and pushing. It's actually through relaxing and releasing, you know. But you have to stay, you know. And you need the right container and the right conditions for this to work, you know. One of the tricky things when you kind of go from the calm into just kind of seeing how things work, because in a way, this is all about studying, you know, sometimes there's subtle movements towards and against things, you know. And the word klesa, or, you know, it actually poisons. The klesa come, and there are really, they are based on this thing of, you know, that pleasantness, when, you know, it's unconscious, will turn to wanting, and wanting will turn to greed. You know, it's not complicated. In the same way that, you know, unpleasant arises, and you know, it's just unpleasant. And yet, you know, you're all really good at, sometimes it's, you know, some people just dissociate. Some people push back. And some people get incredibly reactive. I think it's called anger, you know? So these are the modalities of simply dealing with one of these klesas, you know? And, you know, they always say, you know, when I speak about them, I'm a delusional type, I want you to know. But things have changed a little bit. I've been practicing for a while. But the tradition is, you know, how do you know what kind of type you are in some way? You already know, but anyway, I'll just kind of state this, you know. So a person walks in the room, And they look and just go, God, I want one of those. You know, I should have two of those, you know. And you know what that is, you know. The next person comes to him and said, why did he put it there? He should have put it over there, you know. And so, you know, again, and then, of course, the delusional type walks in and goes, huh? But one of the interesting things of kind of working on this stuff is I've gone from a delusional type to a greed type. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, fortunately, I haven't got to the other one so much yet. But I suspect it's also there. You know? But I hope, you know, as we go get along here, the idea is not that you're going to change who you are. You're going to wake up to who you are. And waking up means that you have choice. Being asleep means you simply follow the impulses. And our job here is to wake up so we know when those impulses somehow begin to either push us towards something, so we're going to grab a hold of it and hang on, or we're going to end up pushing away. And sometimes they're not so subtle, these things, you know. And other times they start out so simple, you know, and next thing you know, you know, she said that, he said this, and next thing you're fired up and you're, you know, off and running. And by the way, I have to tell you, if you are off and running, there's not a damn thing you're going to do about it. You know, until you wake up, it's just, you know, it's like, it's a movie, and you're kind of sucked into it. And hopefully, why we train to bring our attention back into the body breath is to see that, I'm not in that, I'm here. And sometimes when we notice we're here, then the wonders of being here is we let go of it. You know? It's kind of tricky because sometimes it just, you let go of it and it comes back again and you have to do it a few times. You know? Not so simple. So once we've kind of collected and we have some insight, and the insight process is, you know, it's kind of pivotal. There's kind of levels of this. There's first of all, you all have insights. Yes, all the time. And then out of that insight, you take action. And the more the faster you go in the world and you're moving around, and what is that insight based on? On me, of course. You know, it's actually very surface material, and it's all based on me, what I like and what I don't like. So it's really I, me, mine. And, you know, sometimes people spend their whole life and they're very lucky, everything goes okay, you know. Then there's another. And that other is the fact that, we actually see with this insight into, in a sense, that operating system, you know. And it, once we see into it, then, you know, oh, you know what? I think I need to get off of this train. You know, it's actually not doing or going where I want. You know, and that means you have to have the wherewithal to do that. You know? And why we're here is we start at the surface of things, and probably still a lot of surface material going on, but the idea is to go below the surface, to actually go down. And as we go down, one of the unusual truths about going down, the Buddha was only interested in what was kind of deeper in the psyche, you know, is that kind of, it is kind of a scatteredness of I, me, mine. and always it's always about me, you know. And suddenly that begins to thin a little, and one begins to open to, oh, this is a bigger world we're living in, and I hope this is what we're doing here, is that we're trying to get below the kind of the I, me, mine, the surface of the material. And as we begin to go down, then we see that there is, you could say it's kind of a breaking down of the separateness. You know? And suddenly the difference between, there's suddenly, I'll say this, you know, instead of wanting to hunt the bear, there's compassion for the bear. You know, because the bear is part of us. You know? And so the sense of dropping below the kind of scatteredness and the kind of, it is the kind of greed and hatred and illusion of the surface, we begin to, in a sense, kind of soften and see ultimately kind of the interconnectedness of things, the non-separateness. And this is really what the Buddha was interested in. Oh, let's get underneath it all. The separateness was actually, it was the big trick. It was the great delusion that somehow to satisfy me, you know. And so we're all here in this, we're here for these 7 days to kind of, you're gonna go down, you're gonna bounce back up again, I know. And you'll go down, you'll bounce back up again. But, and even sometimes we don't even notice that we're actually going deeper. And that there is every time we have these, you know, stories, we think, oh, they're same story, you know? I just played it again. It hasn't changed, you know? But actually, this is it. It's not the story. It's the context it's in. And if it's in the context of a more wider sphere instead of small I, me, mine, then it has a different kind of flavor to it. Oh, I kind of get it, you know? And it hasn't changed the situation. It's just changed our, and you could say how we're looking at it, our view of it. You know? So the fundamental insights before I move on to this one taste. Something you will keep learning. I don't think any of these that I'm going to speak of, can you go to the depth of them unless you become enlightened. And the first one is impermanence, you know. And the way your mind works is that its nature is to freeze things, to concretize things, so it feels safe. You know, so it's going around creating a solid theater so that you feel safe in your environment and your connections. But here, the practice is that that begins to break up. And what was where the mind is solidifying it, it suddenly is releasing it. And begins to see that, oh no, you know what? Everything is like this. It's all this impermanent phenomena that's arising and passing away. And suddenly, instead of being afraid, I feel comfort by it. Oh, it's okay, you know? It's all right, you know? Causes and conditions, you were born. Causes and conditions are, you know, you will die. I don't know how, but you will die. That's the cause of conditions, even though I think somehow something in our genetic code tells us you, but not me, you know? And so there is this kind of cultural delusion around permanence and life. And I think if we could understand it a little more and see it with a little kind of not so narrow, but a kind of wider perspective. We would act differently. There wouldn't be such fear, there wouldn't be such hoarding, there wouldn't be such sense of loneliness or separateness. That was all part of the package, of kind of solidifying our world. And then we don't get it. Then we see, this is really into nature, that nature arises and passes away. And that due to that, that we all beings want to be happy. You know? But you think of, Syria or Iraq or Bangladesh or, the world's a mess. And we are most privileged creatures, for whatever kind of allowed us to be here, the kind of karmic consequences. And there should be some sense of, if from the more the universal, of the privilege. Oh my gosh. And if we could have a little better understanding of the privilege, then there would be a sense of kindness that would not create separateness. It would actually create understanding and loving kindness and compassion. And another one that's hard for people to understand of kind of these universal insights is, it's kind of difficult in Buddhist terminology, this idea of no self, And I'll probably play on this because it's a great play. And they talk about it as two truths, the relative self and the absolute self. And from the Buddhist point of view, he says, I went down to the deepest point and I found no single thing. No thing. No. So there wasn't something that was identifiable. No. And so in that, there is this, I see it as a tremendous freedom. Now I don't have to be holding anything, in the ultimate sense. I'm simply free from all the concepts around how it is. On the other side, I'm John. I have a history. I always joke I'm neurotic. I am caught in my past, and I'm trying to modify the consequences of my past to awaken. We're all doing the same thing here. So at some point, get deep enough and we have a thing called letting go. It's really what the single taste is, where one kind of breaks the bonds of duality, about self and other. And I'm not saying it's just, these are the principles behind this, is to go to that place where we break the dualism. And if we break that dualism, then, they talk about it as kind of a single taste. It is simply, there is this. And I like in the Zen, they talk about, they use the word suchness. The suchness. So the suchness of things, it is in essence complete. As it is in itself. And because we no longer are separating between self and other, there is a great gift called life. And so that one taste is actually a great, great happiness. It is completely unattached. So good luck with that. You know, but I'm trying to give you kind of, this is a little bit of map, an ideal. You know? And once we kind of, it's really somewhat breaking the bonds of of a life of self and other, of a dualism, is this fourth part, which is undisturbed awareness. And so when, in a sense, we've kind of broken that bond and we understand it, even though we live in the relative world, but we have some sense of that. And many people have experiences that kind of break, for a moment, maybe just a second or two, the bonds, you know. And because of that, you know, then what I spoke about last night, about turning the mind around and noticing what it is aware. It's simply aware of itself. You know? And as I said, it doesn't have an age. It is out of time. It's not about time. It's actually something that was inherent. It was something you were born with. And so part of this whole process of this path of this journey is to arrive where you began. No. Because when you were little, you had this. But due to comparison, you know, and kind of wanting it this way or that way, you kind of split the world. And so now we're back at, oh, I want to unify and bring my mind, my that knows. I want to befriend that and recognize that not only was it always there, it held everything, you know. And so it wasn't something that I could achieve. It was something to be realized. You follow the difference? Because one takes effort, and the other one, actually, what ultimately this takes is embodiment, which is why we try to teach so much about, well, just stay in your body. All you have to do is kind of stay in your body, you know, and realize there's a knowing that can begin to be stabilized. And that's really hopefully where we're going with this. We begin to stabilize, like, oh, I know this. You already know this, by the way. But they say it has to be pointed out, but then you have to remember it, you know. And that's kind of the game here. You know? So we have to go through this process, and we'll go through it. You have to almost go through it the whole over and over again. And then one starts, you know, maybe it's just a beginning to trust that I don't need to play the game. I don't have to kind of always be caught in this us and them paradigm, you know, that actually there's another paradigm. The paradigm is just here, you know, just kind of the suchness of it. And then there's a naturally deep relaxing that is, it's grateful and it's inclusive. So it includes everything and everybody. So how's that? Okay. If you didn't get it, it's okay. Because, you know, I'll keep just, I just go. go around it and around it until, you know. You know, sometimes I think Dharma talks, sometimes it's just one sentence. That, you know, it's something, the insights kind of goes in. And as we get here, we get more sensitive, and so it really is, this is kind of, to me, it's kind of an intuitive process of kind of just talking. And sometimes it's just one line, and it goes in, and it kind of drops down, and it begins its own process, you know, its own insight process. How's that? So let's just sit for a moment here.